This is John Floridis. Welcome to Musicians Spotlight. Our guest today is John Lenti. This is John Floridis. Welcome to Musicians Spotlight. I am very pleased to be speaking today with lutenist John Lenti. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, John?
It's great to see you. First thing in the morning as we're doing this recording, at least by musician standards, most musician standards.
That's true. Yeah. It is, you know, on the early side, yeah. But, you know, that's life these days.
Yeah. Well, it's great to have a chance to talk shop with you here on Musicians Spotlight. John is currently from the Seattle area, and, you know, we were talking a little bit before the interview started about your collegiate studies and so forth, but I'm realizing I don't know where you're from originally.
I'm originally from a little town called Greenwood, South Carolina.
Folks studied there for undergraduate?
Went to the North Carolina School of the Arts for both high school and undergraduate, and then I kicked around for a little while. I went to England for a time, then I went to Indiana University to do a master's degree studying with Nigel North.
Well, I think where I want to start is just, let's just dive in and talk about the instrument. And in full disclosure, as I mentioned, I studied classical guitar myself, and you know, the lute was something you saw in the instruction books. This was pre-internet, of course,
when I was
in college. So you'd see pictures of it and you'd hear some recordings of it. But when I was studying, you never actually saw the instrument. And then suddenly one of my friends purchased one and brought it, and it was like seeing a unicorn or something.
Yeah.
It's like, what is that thing?
I had sort of a similar experience, really, because, you know, I mean, like, the internet wasn't any good when I was in college. It existed, but it was AOL, you know, message thing, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't like you could go and you could look for a thing you were interested in. But, you know, I heard some lute records, and then, I saw it in the history book and the guitar history and you know, I'd seen it in Renaissance paintings. But, I never actually got to touch one until I was, like a freshman in college, because, you know, a dude came through to do a presentation about Renaissance music for the music school. And he brought, you know, a whole pile of instruments, recorders, viola da gambas, the sackbut, which is the trombone. And he had kind of a somewhat clunky lute that he brought. And, you know, I couldn't do a darn thing with it, but it sort of stiffened my resolve to eventually get hold of one.
Yeah. Well, and I wanted to mention, too, for our listeners, I was trying to think of, like, popular cultural references. And, of course, I remembered, Sting did an album of John Dowland tunes, if I'm not mistaken.
We were all hoping for a massive bump in all of our fortunes. You know, we were going to ride that Sting wave, but it didn't quite pan out. Though it's a lovely record, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, I like what he does with that music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then I saw on YouTube there's a cover of him doing, well, it's not a cover tune, it's his own tune, but a lute cover of Message in a Bottle, which was actually beautiful.
Oh, wow.
Gorgeous. But that certainly comes to mind. I remember watching The Tudors on Showtime, and they showed Henry VIII, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, composing Greensleeves, which I understand is actually completely false. He didn't really compose.
Right.
Not Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, but Henry VIII did not compose.
Neither of them composed Greensleeves.
Sadly enough. Well, let's dive into what really drew you into that instrument, and then what drew you to that type of music?
It starts with the music for me more than anything. The instruments are wonderful and they're fun and everything. But the thing for me is that I was a classical guitarist, but I was raised by two piano players. And so, you know, when I was a kid, I grew up hearing, you know, Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms and Bach and Schubert and Schumann and all that stuff. And then when I got to the guitar, I initially liked playing folk music and rock and roll and things like that. But since classical music was the family business, you know, I got into playing classical guitar. And what I found is that for the music of the classical period, the romantic period, nothing that I was able to play on the guitar was at the level of the great literature for piano, string quartet, violin, symphony orchestra, things like that. Like, I never found the music quite as richly satisfying as the music that I'd always heard. But what I found was Renaissance music. The lute in the Renaissance was the equivalent of the piano in the Romantic period, and it's got a repertory that you can never exhaust, never ever. So much great music, and it sounds pretty nice on guitar. Like, guitar players can play lute music the same way pianists play Bach that was written for harpsichord. Mm-hmm. And so over the course of my undergraduate education, I got to the point in my senior year, I was getting ready for my senior recital, you know, to graduate college. And there were two guitar pieces on the program, and everything else was lute music. So it was like an hour of lute music and 10 minutes of guitar tunes. And my dad, who, you know, was always interested in what I was doing and, you know, was saying, "So what's going to be on your recital program, son?" I told him, you know, all this lute stuff, little, you know, smattering of guitar. And he told me to get a lute. And luckily, in Asheville, North Carolina, not so far from where I lived at the time, there was a guy named Larry Brown who built lutes. I think the truth is I was never that happy as a classical guitarist. There's some part of me that always kind of thinks that being a classical guitarist might be a little bit like being a classical saxophonist, where it's sort of like, it ain't really what the guitar is for. You know, the guitar is for, you know, is for singing songs. It's the instrument of the people. Uh-huh. You know, it's got all of these genres in which it excels. You know, I mean, there's blues and jazz and rock and roll and heavy metal and flamenco and all of the folk musics of the world. So, you know, it's sort of like, why do you want to play classical music on an instrument like that? Then the lute.
Andre Segovia on line one.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I know there are going to be some complaints. That's just my personal weird feeling, you know. Like,
that's great.
Because, you know, I mean, there are a great many classical guitarists who I think do wonderful work. But for me, I always felt like, you know, I wasn't doing the right thing. So when I got that lute, it was, you know, I spent a year teaching myself to play it and cut my fingernails for the first time in like 15 years, which was agonizing. Because if you grow your fingernails out for a long time and then you cut them, the nail bed, the fingertip is like, you know, it's like a newborn baby's, you know. And so that was...
Soft shell crabs, somebody said to me one time.
Yeah. And so after that, I just sort of buckled down. I got rid of all of my stuff. I went to England to study with this particular teacher whose work I particularly admired, Jacob Herringman. And that was kind of the hard breakup that I referred to earlier with the classical guitar. You know, sort of, you know, I made a fairly clean break, though it was kind of hard to go from being pretty good at something to being really lousy at the thing that I loved more than anything. That was kind of tough.
This is John Floridis. You're listening to Musicians Spotlight, and I'm speaking today with lutenist John Lenti. John, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was the immersion in the music of a very particular time and place, really.
Yeah.
We're talking about Europe in the Renaissance and Baroque eras. And I was trying to think of analogies to other musicians that we've had on the program, and I'm thinking of, I suppose you could say people who are musicians who are drawn to traditional jazz, if there's such a thing. Mm-hmm. Even that involves obviously a level of improvisation. Bluegrass musicians who dive into, very traditional bluegrass, maybe, yeah. Or traditional folk musics. We were talking about Irish music beforehand, but the difference is with this music, with period music, as it's called, mm-hmm. Is that I think that the assumption is that you're trying to reproduce something as faithfully as possible, where even those other genres that might have some similarity to that, to this, there's levels of give and take, because it's all kind of music that started in maybe the late 19th century, at the earliest, but we're going back hundreds of years. And I just wanted to ask about just how you as a musician approach that task, I guess.
Oh, well, it's good you mentioned folk music, because actually that was a part of how I think I sort of really crystallized my interest in this. When I lived in North Carolina, I played in an old time band. That was actually one of my primary creative outlets for a long while, was playing guitar and clawhammer banjo and a little bit of bass and singing in bars. And the thing is, the old time community in North Carolina, some parts of it are incredibly pedantic, like in a way that I find really deeply appealing, personally, because I'm the kind of person who grows up to be a lute player. but sort of, I guess, for me, that particular, that particular endeavor was a search for a kind of authenticity. And that's the same thing that sort of, fuels a lot of my interest in what I'm doing, playing the Renaissance and Baroque music. With a lot of the other great musics in the world, we can listen to recordings, even in classical music for the 19th century, you can go and listen to recordings by people that were born in 1860 something. They might have been well on in years by the time they got in front of the Edison thing. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, you can kind of hear the sorts of time that they were taking and the stretches that they were doing and the sort of plaintive quality that they seem to cherish. And then, with folk music, you can go and listen to the Alan Lomax collection and hear, what the actual old Norwegian farmer really was doing with his fiddle. With the Renaissance and Baroque music, we've got, of course, no recordings really, but what we do have is great reams of treatises and method books and things. And you can sort of see that, so much of what is described in terms of how to play the instrument, how to hold the instrument, how to conceive of making sound on the instrument is devoted to just the heightening of expression. And, and of course the other thing about Baroque music is, and Renaissance music also, is ornamentation, which introduces an element of improvisation to everything that you do. Hmm. Like I improvise a lot, particularly accompanying people, but when I'm playing music that's fully written out, I also get to improvise, because you're always responsible for beautifying the music in some way. Thank you.
John, you mentioned, first of all, I wanted to touch on the concept of improvisation in this kind of music, which I think is important for listeners to hear, because we don't tend to think of improvisation in big air quotes here, classical music at all, let alone Baroque and Renaissance music. And yet, if you delve in deeper, of course, that is a part of what's going on, a big part of what's going on. The other thing I wanted to talk about was the setting in which this music would have been heard, or you know, where it would have been experienced.
Right.
Because for modern listeners, where we experience this is either, well, if we experience it in a live setting, they're in these beautiful, you know, recital halls.
Right.
Or I know you mentioned in another interview that you did for Montana Public Radio that one of the things that you like about playing in Montana is that historically there were, you know, there were booms in different industries that produced these architecturally interesting houses with big areas where you can have where you can experience that music in a more intimate level.
Yeah, because every town has a millionaire's row.
Right. Yeah.
And with great big gorgeous drawing rooms with wood paneling and
and those are experiences that people have to really be able to seek out to experience this music in that way. But let's go back to when it was composed and when it was being performed actively. Right. What were some of the settings that that this music would have been experienced in?
Well, a small amount of the music that we play now would have been intended for big public performances of the kind that it is now given. You know, like a lot of the music of Handel, for instance, was big, impressive music intended for, you know, large forces in front of large crowds. But, you know, a huge part of my time is spent playing chamber music and smaller music that would have been performed in small settings. You know, it was music in many cases, like a lot of the music that I play with smaller groups is probably more participatory music than it is performance music, you know, in that it was published for people to play in their homes. You know, it was intended for that purpose. And, so you can sort of, you know, imagine that, you know, in a lot of cases it would have been some upper class people who were all very well-trained musicians playing and enjoying this music just among themselves. Yeah, the settings, I think, were, you know, as diverse as, you know, really spectacular royal courts, less spectacular courts of the lower nobility, relatively unspectacular drawing rooms of the bourgeoisie, but you know, by the time of London in the 18th century, a lot of pubs had upstairs rooms where they put on concerts, and Johann Sebastian Bach in Leipzig got together with a bunch of university students, and they set up a concert series at Zimmermann's Coffee House in Leipzig. And, you know, and they'd get together there and put on performances of the great works of Bach and Telemann and Handel and Vivaldi. And, you know, so there are certain crucial ways in which I kind of think it's fair game to play this music wherever you want to do it.
John, we've been talking in great detail about specifically what you do as a musician and the music that you play. When you're not performing this music, when you are not traveling across the country to do this very thing and doing interviews and trying to talk about it, what else are you doing for fun?
I'm a stay-at-home dad.
There you go. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. So
congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have a 2.5-year-old son called Victor. You know, during the concert season, I'm gone about 60% of the time, which is way, way, way too much. But this is, you know, this is all I can do. So I gotta put food on my family, as
sure.
they say.
Sure.
So when I'm home, I'm a stay-at-home dad. The way that it works, I get up and usually try to feed my wife and son some breakfast. She goes off to work. Victor and I kick around and have a ball, taking advantage of the various wonderful things that Seattle has to offer, museums and playgrounds and parks and zoos and all that sort of thing. A lot of my time is devoted to practice. I still like to play the clawhammer banjo. I've occasionally gotten together with friends to play old-time music. But my wife and I also used to like to go out to dinner and see movies once in a while. And, you know, so basically now it's kind of like just keep our heads above water.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. Someday I'll have hobbies again.
Yeah. And watch a steady diet of Victor TV.
Exactly. Yeah.
John, where would folks go online if they wanted to find out more about what you're doing and find out more about your music?
Like you say, we're recording this in November. I have owned the domain name johnlenti.com for 8 years. I've got it, you know, just on my credit card with GoDaddy, and it automatically renews. I have done nothing, but I resolve here and now that by the time this program airs, they will be able to go to johnlenti.com.
You know, I'm thinking in Seattle, Washington, there might be a few folks that know their way around.
There's some computer guys
the interwebs.
There. Yeah. You know. Like my wife, actually.
Well, there you
go. Like, yeah, she,
Victor pretty soon will
Victor
be able to.
Victor will be able to do this, yeah probably by the age
son.
Of six. You know,
yeah.
And yeah, so... I've got a lot of stuff up on YouTube.
Great.
Yeah.
JohnLenti, in case folks are wondering how to spell your name.
Yep.
Thank you so much for making time to stop by and chat and talk shop with us here on Musician's Spotlight. Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, John. It was really a good time. I appreciate it a lot.
This is John Floridis. You've been listening to Musician's Spotlight. Our guest today has been John Lenti. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so through the Montana Public Radio website, mtpr.org, as well as through our own website, musicianspotlight.org. You can also find us online on Facebook and on Twitter. Our program is available as a downloadable podcast from those websites, as well as through iTunes. Musicians Spotlight is a production of Montana Public Radio.